The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
This is so delightful to look out at this audience and see all these little girls out here, I have to say. So my name is Shara Polly. Excuse the glasses, I can't see a thing. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation. I want to take a moment at the beginning of my remarks to welcome the Board of Trustees from the Philadelphia Ballet who are with us this evening. So it really is my honor tonight to introduce Misty Copeland. I'm going to try to keep my composure because I have to tell you that the inspiration that I personally get from this woman's life story, from her commitment to her art and to her resilience in the face of so many challenges, is, I think, a life lesson for all of us. And another reason why I'm so delighted that there are so many young people in the audience today, because I think that listening to Misty tell the story of how she has become the dancer and the woman that she is through a life that really did not necessarily steer her easily in that direction is something for all of us to listen to very closely and really to be inspired by. So it is an honor for me to even share the stage with her and to be able to introduce her and welcome her into your lives this evening. So Misty was the first African-American principal dancer in the history of the elite American Ballet Theater. She is the author of the New York Times bestsellers Life in Motion, Ballerina Body, Black Ballerinas, and the children's books Bunheads and Firebird, which I bet some of the people in this audience have read. She's the recipient of the Springhorn Medal from the NAACP. She's an inductee in the Boys and Girls Club Alumni Hall of Fame. She is one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People and one of Glamour's Women of the Year. Tonight, we're celebrating the release of her new book, The Wind at My Back, which is a memoir about her formative and enduring relationship with friend, mentor, and trailblazing ballet dancer, Raven Wilkinson. Tonight, Ms. Copeland will be in conversation with Tamala Edwards, anchor of 6ABC Action News. So we are so pleased to have them with us this evening. Please join me, give a heartfelt welcome to Misty Copeland.
What a joy. And what an honor. I think you can feel the love in the room.
Yes, I can.
We have to give this lady a round of applause. And these shoes, I told her, you have a right to be out here in fuzzy slippers. But you are here to talk about a topic very dear to you, somebody very dear to you,
yes.
Raven Wilkinson. And I wanted to know why you wanted to do this book, because you touched on this in a children's book mm-hmm. and in a documentary. What made you say, no, I need to go back?
Oh, man. So with Firebird, which was, dedicated to Raven, and it was really about our relationship and the importance of mentorship and what that looks like for a younger generation. The documentary, it was very small, a little bit. I mean, Raven stole the show in that scene where we're doing the Four Little Swans together in my apartment. But I felt like I needed to really share her story in its entirety, the impact that she's had on the ballet community from, 1955 up until she stepped on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera House and handed me flowers at my first Swan Lake in New York City as the Swan Queen. And also our story, the impact that she had on me to really be able to do her justice, which I don't feel like enough people know her story that should.
So let's start there. And why don't you tell, because if people haven't bought the book yet or haven't had a chance to see the documentary, who is she and why was she? I'm sure you met plenty of people in your time. Why was it so different and special to you when you met her?
Yeah. I mean, there are so many incredible Black women and Black ballerinas who have made such an impact on me and on the world. There was something about the timing, I think, of Raven's story and the connection I felt to her experience and my own. I learned about Raven in 2010, which is terrible that I went for so many years of my professional career not knowing that she even existed. It was in 2010 that I was watching a documentary on the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo, which is really like, you know, the first American ballet company, one of the greatest of the 20th century. And I had no idea that there was a Black woman that existed in this company. Raven joined the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo in 1955. She was the first and only Black woman to dance in the company. She was promoted to soloist within a couple of years, which is, it's still unheard of today. So in that time, it was like unbelievable. You know, her talent was incredible. She toured with the company for about 2 years before segregation. Once the company, you know, was in the 50s and they were touring through the South, that's when her experience completely changed. Every time they toured through the South, which they did often, her life was being threatened by the KKK. And, you know, I mean, terrible, terrible things that were happening to her, and ended up ending her career after only 7 years in America. And she ended up moving to Amsterdam, where she had a very full career with the Dutch National Ballet in Amsterdam before coming back to New York. But she was never accepted in any other American company outside of the Ballet Russe because of the color of her skin. But she made such a huge impact on so many people's lives who came into contact with her, including my own.
She was a very private person, but she loved to tell you her stories, mm-hmm. and she let you in to a certain degree. And as you began to tell her story, it's an inside and an outside thing. There's the outside world. And to put a finer point on it, in the book, she tells Misty the story of going down south, and the Klan comes storming in, and this is a light-skinned woman, and their dancers are of all colors. They can't figure out who is who. But you're trying to do your work, and people in Klan robes are yelling, "Who is the nigger?" And this is what she lived through. But equally hurtful were people who could stand up for her in that moment and yet say to her, "You will never be a white swan," for mm-hmm. no good reason. Mm-hmm. Did she ever let on which one hurt more?
No, but I know that it hurt her deeply to hear this from colleagues of hers, who she spent most of her career not hearing those words from, who, you know, she felt supported her. But, you know, when it came down to it, you know, Raven never looked at these situations as her being a victim, or, you know, she learned from all of the situations that she experienced, and she would share that with me. You know, she even had empathy for these people that would say these words to her. I mean, the ballerina that said to her, Nina Novak, who was a principal ballerina with the Ballet Russe, you know, after having years and years of just a beautiful relationship with this woman, it was towards the end of her time at the Ballet Russe, Raven's time, that Nina expressed that she didn't think that she would ever go further. And so Raven had an understanding, like, I don't think that she was doing this to hurt me, but she was expressing the realities of the ballet community and the ballet world. Like, you will never be a white swan. You will never be the swan queen, because that's not something that's granted to a woman of color, especially a Black woman. Though it hurt her, she felt like, you know, like, you're right, I guess it might be my time to, like, start thinking about what the next steps are. But I know that it was hearing those words from people that she trusted and thought she had a different type of relationship with, or a different understanding coming from, you know, being artists, that really hurt her.
She tries to leave dance. She becomes a nun and then realizes, I can't do it. I've got to go back to dancing. But as I read her story, and you say this over and over again, that she has such joy. You always describe her as at parties dancing with a twinkle in her eye. And it's not just that. It's the way that she embraces you. She could have been bitter. She could have been hurt. If only I'd been born X number of years later. And instead, it's only in kindness and in joy. And I thought that was her greatness, that she didn't get bitter. And I wanted you to talk about that.
Yeah, it's an unbelievable quality that she had that I feel like I learned so much from by being in her presence. Raven was such a unique mentor and teacher in that I never felt like she was teaching me. It's an amazing thing to have those people in your life. But I have so many of those people that fulfill that need, whether it's my coaches or teachers or other amazing mentors in my life that will literally sit me down and say, like, don't do this, do this. Like, this is what you need to do to get here, you know, especially as a Black woman. But Raven just celebrated me. And she would share stories. And I knew, I'm lucky that I met her at the, you know, at a later stage in my career. You know, I wasn't in my teens. I was old enough to decipher and kind of see the little gems that she was dropping in sharing the stories that she was without having to spell it out for me. But she was so unique in that she never talked badly about people. I mean, she even had empathy and sympathy for the Ku Klux Klan members. Like, it was shocking to me. I remember telling me this story about before she, you know, she did stay in some hotels where she, they didn't know she was Black, so she would stay with the other company members before, you know, they really were segregated and she would have to stay in Blacks only hotels. But they were in the cafe at this hotel. And she walked in and she was like, oh, there's so much love in this room and all these families with their children. And she sat down at a table and was just like appreciating the love in the room. And she looked at the table next to her and it was stacked high with all the white like cloaks. And she realized like, oh my goodness, this is a room full of the KKK. But was like, it's so interesting to see that they're human beings and that they learned this somewhere. Mm-hmm. And that was just her incredible power and strength, was her resilience, her hope, her grace. And it definitely is something that I feel like I think about on a daily basis, when especially when dealing with adversity.
There's power in being seen. And when you walk out in this room and you are embraced, it means so much to everyone here that you are seen, because they are seen. When you talk about Raven and finding that video, if you hadn't found that video, how could she have been there? And you're someone deep in this world and didn't know. And she's not the only person you mention in the book. Somebody will come to a company and leave and won't be replaced and you never hear. They go overseas and you don't hear about their career. And I was listening to a podcast this week with Tressie McMillan Cotton, and she was talking about Blackness and how you literally aren't seen. She had a man sit on her as if he couldn't see her. And as I was listening to this, as I was reading your book, and what it means that you're there, but you're not seen, and when you're gone, you're erased as if you were not there. What does that mean, that history in ballet, that there are these forefathers and foremothers, and even someone like you may not know of them?
I mean, it makes me feel that, you know, I have an incredible responsibility and an incredible opportunity with the reach and visibility that I have outside of the ballet community. I feel like that's been my strength and power, is being able to share my story and have it resonate with so many people that are not just Black, that can understand what it is to be, to feel alone or feel like you don't fit in or, you know, feel different, or, you know, what it is to be a part of something that's bigger than you and want to succeed. But it's an incredible responsibility, and I think it's important for me to share the stories of so many who have come before me and acknowledge them. Like, you know, the book before this one that I wrote a year ago called Black Ballerinas, the reason that I wrote that was I felt such like this sense of urgency that we were losing our history in the classical ballet world, you know, with the death of Arthur Mitchell and then Raven. You know, within a year, I lost like three of my mentors in the ballet community, like black dancers. And I felt like I have to get this in writing and write our history, because it doesn't exist. It's not something that's lent to us. So it's something that I feel like it's just, it's equally as important and a part of my path as getting up and taking ballet class every morning.
You talk in this book also about your own journey. You are in your 30s when you become a principal. You should have been a principal much earlier than that. Incredible career. And Raven is key, and you point this out. She's not someone to make a big deal and demand. She'll just quietly say something. And as you express doubt, she'll say, well, maybe you should go talk to somebody about that. Mm-hmm. Why do you think it was more powerful coming from her than maybe somebody who presented it in a different way?
Mm-hmm. I feel like within my own experience and my personality as the fourth of six children, as a shy, introverted Virgo, there's definitely like an approach that I needed in order for me to feel connected and heard and communicate in a way that worked for me. And Raven just had a way that connected with me, that it was, she showed me through her actions and her example of how to stand up for herself, have pride, and not push me to do something that was kind of, I mean, it was outside of my comfort zone, but it wasn't in a way that didn't work for me. And so, you know, an example, something as simple as just going to my artistic director and having a constructive conversation with him. You know, there were, I think, 8 soloist women at American Ballet Theatre, and I was the only black woman. And every single one of them was cast as the Princess Florine, the Bluebird in the Sleeping Beauty, except for me. There were also corps de ballet members that were cast in this role. And so I felt like, well, I must, what's going on? I mean, isn't that what the point of being a soloist is that you're going to get soloist roles? And Raven suggested, you know, and I think as dancers, we're often, you know, told and shown like to just perform, but not to have a voice and not to, you know, advocate for ourselves and have agency over our careers. And Raven was the opposite in her approach. And she just said, you know, I'm sure there are many dancers who have asked these questions before you, and encouraged me to go into the office and have this conversation with my boss. And it was very revealing to have those types of conversations. You know, the same thing we're talking about feeling unseen and unheard. But to have my artistic director tell me, oh, I thought you'd been performing that role, was shocking to me and just made me really realize how important it was for me to have a voice. And Raven was such a big part of pushing me to stand up for myself and to say something. And, you know, from there I was cast in the role. And it was an approach I had moving forward in the future.
I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about your own journey for the young girls in the room. Because in the book you discuss, as you're coming up on these big moments, it's harrowing. And you've got muscle memory. You know that you know a lot of this stuff down pat. But there, and you're in physical pain at some points, but it's also nerves and pushing mm-hmm. yourself. And even though you were on point, I think it was within 3 months of trying ballet, like you were born to do this, you too have anxiety. You too have self-doubt. And I wanted you to talk to them a little bit about the whole world can say, of course you can do this and it's great. But what do you do inside when you're fighting that battle?
Yeah. Thank you for asking this question, because it's so important for so many of the young people and dancers in the audience to hear is, you know, once just because you reach a certain level of success doesn't mean that you don't have insecurities or have to keep working to maintain a certain level. And, you know, I've felt different, I guess, responsibility stepping onto the stage in these roles where, you know, so many generations of black women and black people before me were told that we cannot do this, these aren't the rules for us. It's made me feel, I mean, that I have to be perfect every time I step onto the stage. And that shouldn't be the approach that, you know, we have. And when you're entering into this very sacred space where you're supposed to be entertaining people and making them feel good and connect with you and telling a story through our movement. But I have often felt that type of pressure, you know, especially when approaching these roles like a Swan Lake or a Giselle, especially in these Ballet Blanc ballets, which are white ballets that were literally like created for white dancers, where black women are just, you know, told that we ruin the aesthetic and break the line. So in those roles in particular, I felt like an added amount of pressure that if I failed in whoever's eyes, the gatekeepers, whoever that may be, the critics, the self-appointed critics, that if I failed in their eyes, would there be another opportunity for a black girl coming up after me? And those were the things I was thinking about before I entered the stage that were debilitating, physically debilitating. And, you know, you train in your whole life to be able to just go on stage and execute these technical feats, you know, pretty effortlessly because you put so many years into it. And my mental was taking over and not allowing for me to do it.
At one point in my career, somebody said to me, listen, you're driving the bus, because in every career, you have your ups and downs. And she said, that bus doesn't go without you. So whatever else is going on, you tell these people, I'm driving the bus. You
like
have
that.
A moment like that when it's time for Swan Lake and your leg is hurting. And there's a key moment when you're the black swan where you're supposed to whip around. And, what is it, 16, 32 times?
32 times in the fouettés.
And you decide to do it differently in a way that works for you. You tell the story in the book as almost failing, but I thought that is power. Deciding to stop and make it work for you. And mm-hmm. everybody out there, I wanted them to hear this mm-hmm. because that's something to choose what's best for me. Tell them that story.
Yeah, you know, it's a combination of, I think, when you're so deep in it and every day you're striving for this thing that's expected of you and that's that you assume the audience is expecting to see this technical feat that has become the norm in certain ballets like Swan Lake and Don Quixote and some Nutcrackers, Le Corsaire, the 32 Fouettés. And I've had to step back. I mean, throughout, I don't know, my time as a principal dancer in particular is reminding myself that I'm there to tell a story. And what do these movements mean? We're not, there's no movement in the ballet technique and the ballet vocabulary that's just there for nothing. They're all transition steps. They're all there to tell a story. And that's what's so beautiful about the ballet technique that I'm so drawn to and have been drawn to since I was 13. But, you know, when I was having this difficulty because of an injury that I had to have to my leg that I'm still dealing with to this day, and not being able to physically do what I needed to do, it also made me step back and reassess what it is I'm saying with that movement. And with the 32 Fouettés in Swan Lake, the original choreography wasn't even 32 Fouettés. Mm. It was a menage of pique turns. And we're there to make the prince feel that he's in this whirlwind, dizzy with love or ecstasy or whatever it is he's feeling for the black swan, trying to convince him that we are the white swan. And the point is to literally, it's like our last chance to convince him. And over time, there was one ballerina, I think it was an Italian ballerina, that was really good at these 32 Fouettés, and it became a staple. And I decided to do turns from fifth instead of the pique, or instead of the 32 Fouettés. Eventually, I would do the menage, which caused such a frenzy in the audience because I think it was something they weren't expecting, and it gave that effect that you're supposed to be accomplishing. But, you know, in the moment, not executing the 32 Fouettés, and in the back of my mind feeling like everyone in the audience is expecting this, it felt like a complete failure.
In the book, you talk about your own journey. There's one ballet where you have to put white powder on your skin. Mm-hmm. That's where the ballet was at that point. Towards the end of the book, after George Floyd, there's also a moment when the Balanchine Ballet is in blackface, and you say this isn't okay, and they want you to apologize for saying something. And then after George Floyd, conversations open up. Tell people a little bit about the trajectory of what you've lived through, what you've seen, and where you think things are now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen a lot in my 20-plus years as a professional in the ballet world. I think one of the first things, like, at this point is addressing, you know, the fact that, again, going back to the basics of what it is we're doing, we're telling a story. And that story is so beautifully told in so many different body types and ethnicities and communities, and that it's so much more rich and full when you see it that way, when you see representation and you see yourself. But, you know, having to pancake your skin another color in order to fit in, or, you know, certain ballets that to this day in Europe or in Russia in particular are still being performed in blackface. Like, these are things that we shouldn't even have to be addressing at this point. But it's a responsibility that I feel like I have by having the voice that I have to push people and challenge the ballet community that's existed in this very insular bubble for so long, that it's time to make change. And I feel like post George Floyd and, you know, throughout the pandemic, the arts being pushed to live in a different space, you know, that when theaters weren't readily available and open, like, how do we continue on? How do we reach more people and being able to access people on social media and YouTube and through the internet is so powerful and so vast. And we have a responsibility when we're reaching that many people. And, you know, with the whole Bolshoi and blackface situation, I felt that it was so important for me to say something, because within that theater, like, they're not just playing to their community there in Moscow. They're posting these images on Instagram where so many people can see them, and they have a responsibility. And, you know, I've definitely pushed the conversation in a lot of ways, and I feel like the ballet community is addressing these issues and topics in a way that I've never experienced in all my time in this field. Within the last 3 years is like the most change that I've ever seen, where, you know, it's not just the pageantry and it's not just these diversity initiatives where they put their one black dancer on the pamphlet and no real change is happening, but that these are conversations that are happening internally within the ballet community, and I'm just going to forever be fighting for our voices to be heard.
And we have to say thank you, because on a lot of those calls, you're the only person mm-hmm. on that call, so yeah. Thank you for being there. What do you see as you travel the country and you look at various schools, as you look in New York, when you look at the young dancers, the little girls, when you look at the people in the core, what's coming in the future? And is it different?
Again, I've seen such a big shift in the last couple of years. The real work, I mean, there's so much real work that needs to be done, like from the top and the bottom. But, you know, even for me, and this is not within the ballet community in particular, but for me to be serving on board of directors at Lincoln Center, you know, that's a huge deal for an artist and for a black person and for a black woman. Like, those are big steps that need to be made that are going to make a real change by seeing the board of directors diversified, by seeing teachers within these big institutions be diverse and represent the students that we want to see in these schools, to have more diversity behind the scenes in the education department, you know, that are putting on the productions backstage, the costume designers, the composers of music. All of these things are going to promote real change, and I am seeing it happen. I mean, I think about ABT that just put on their first all-black ballet by the choreographer Christopher Rudd and used a full black cast and a black composer and a black costume designer. That's huge, huge change.
as we close out and we get to start thinking about your questions, we're going to open it up. You've accomplished so many things and so many dreams, but you're so young. What are your dreams and plans for yourself?
Well, in the ballet world, I'm not that young, but...
Well, these days, everybody's younger than me, so there you go.
Oh, there's so much that I want to do and am going to continue to do. I mean, it's all in service of the ballet community and bringing more equity and inclusion to this art form. I'm going to continue to write books. This is my 8th book, which is crazy. I never imagined that I would even be an author. But I'm, you know, excited about my foundation, the Misty Copeland Foundation, and the first signature program that we have that's really along the same lines of how I started ballet. It's free ballet class in the after-school space. Right now it's at 5 Boys and Girls Clubs in the Bronx. And we're hoping to branch out to other communities eventually. You know, just everything that I'm doing, it's connected to ballet in some way and giving back.
As we round this out, Raven has passed. And she was a signifier of her generation. Mm-hmm. She was very private. You never saw the inside of her apartment. And as she got sick, she wanted to handle it in her own way. But you've got the memory of all those conversations. What of all the things she said to you, what stays with you the most? What do you find yourself walking down the street or in a moment thinking of something she said?
There are so many things. I mean, there are so many things I couldn't even put in that book because they were so racy. That Raven... But definitely the title of the book. I mean, those were some of the most powerful words that she said to me that made me not just think about her, but how I can be a representation for so many generations of Black dancers who came before me. But what she would say to me before every single performance, she would call me or leave a voicemail, and she would say, "Let me be the wind at your back when you're on the stage." And I, of course, like I thought of her, but it just made me think of so many Black people that came before me that were the wind at my back, that are the wind at my back every time I'm on the stage.
Maybe that's her lesson, that for all of us, if there's somebody else, that we could be the wind at their back. Mm-hmm. What a legacy.
Yeah.
Is there anybody out there? There has to be somebody out there with questions. Okay, I saw that hand first.
I'm Rebecca. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
I'm an educator for the School District of Philadelphia. I teach 7th graders, and a lot of them have very difficult lives. How can I be the wind at their backs?
Oh, wow. I think it's so important to listen. I think it's important to encourage parents to be involved. I know that can be so difficult for a lot of parents. I mean, I think about my own mother, but I think had there been like a real support system from my teacher, in extending, you know, an invitation for her to be a part of it, I think that's so valuable for your students to feel seen and heard and supported.
Hi, Misty and Tam. My name is Bronwyn, and I'm here with my 2 daughters, Eris and Kinley. And you spoke about anxiety, and sometimes on your level of platform, it's hard to imagine that Misty Copeland has anxiety before performance. But do you have a performance ritual of some sort, and I'm asking for the young ladies and gentlemen in the room that are in other sports, such as gymnastics or soccer, or just anything in general that would help them when they suffer from anxiety, and helping them to prepare and focus their energies for what they need to do.
Thank you. Every day that I'm like preparing to go into the studio and rehearse is the same. I have no different approach when I'm going to perform. And it reminds me that the physical, mental, emotional feats that we accomplish every single day, it's no different than the physical, emotional, mental feats that you will go after in a performance. You're preparing your body day in and day out to be ready for that. So you have to at some point give in and trust that your body and your emotions and your mind are ready and prepared for that. So I don't have, you know, these crazy traditions where, you know, I treat a performance day any more special. I don't change what I'm eating. I just take care of myself every single day.
I prepare myself every single day as if it were a performance, I guess. And I think it's also important to remind yourself of why you're doing it. So there's not a different answer on performance days. You love it, you enjoy the process, you enjoy performing, and you want people to enjoy what you're doing. And so, like, if you're not in it and you're not present and you're not happy, they're probably going to be a little skeptical about what you're doing up there.
You talked about anxiety. I find little kids always say to me, "Do you get scared? Do you get scared?"
Yes, but not of performing. Not really. I mean, of course, like I talked about those rare times, you know, when I've approached like my first Swan Lake and these ballets that have such history. But overall, throughout my career, like being on stage is the most comforting thing for me. Like I've always felt the most safe when I'm on stage. It's a time where, not like right now, where I can see everyone's faces. When I'm performing, it's black. I talk with my hands a lot. You can't see anyone's faces. And there's something it's like you're in your own bubble. And you're just able to express yourself physically and through the music.
Did you know that first moment in the Boys and Girls Club at 13? Did you feel it? Did you know this is my thing?
I wouldn't say like the first day. because of the way I started, because it was on a basketball court and I was literally pushed into doing this thing and I was wearing socks and gym shorts. Just feels like this is so awkward and like this is not something I should be doing. I didn't feel comfortable. But once I was in a ballet studio and I could really focus and be present, I knew it was exactly what I should be doing.
I just want to say thank you for your incredible talent, but also I want to say thank you for your voice.
Thank you.
And a championing this woman and those mentors to you. And here in Philadelphia, we have mentors in ballet,
oh, yes,
such as Essie Marie Dorsey,
oh,
Sydney
yes,
King,
Myers Brown,
the Philodanko, yeah, that have been overlooked too often. So I hope your voice will encourage the media and all of us to celebrate those mentors that we've had for our young dancers here in Philadelphia. Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that.
Hi. So my name's Sydney. I'm a student. So you're a mom, you're a principal dancer, you're an author, you're on the board of directors, you're running your own foundation. How do you do it all, and do you deal with overwhelm? How do you get through it?
Yeah. I have an incredible partner. My husband is like one of the most amazing people in the world. I surround myself with really amazing people that support me. My manager, Gilda Squire, she's right there. But just, I have like an amazing small circle of people that we're all working towards the same purpose. And when I feel overwhelmed, we pull back a little. You know, it's acknowledging that we're all human beings and that we, you know, feel overwhelmed sometimes and that, you know, we have to be responsible and taking care of ourselves first and foremost so that we can continue to do all of this amazing stuff.
Hi, how are you? My
Hi.
Name is Angela. I'm a fellow teacher with the school district. I just want to know, in the beginning of your career, I'm sure you faced adversity. You faced a lot of trials. What was it that kept you going? Because I want to be able to try to help my students that are facing a lot of adversity. Mm-hmm. So what is it that keeps you going when you just want to quit?
I mean, first and foremost, it's just my love of this art form. You know, having felt that I didn't have a voice, you know, coming from the background that I come from, like being one of six children in a single parent home, not often having a home, a roof over our head, food on the table, being a middle child, like just feeling not heard or seen, this art form gave me a purpose and it gave me a voice. And, you know, I just have to remind myself of that feeling, like day in and day out when I, you know, maybe don't feel like I can conquer something. I have to remind myself why I'm doing this, but it's really the passion and the love for it. And, you know, over time, my responsibility has changed and shifted, and so I feel like I have this purpose, you know, of being representation on the stage, to be able to set an example for so many other people.
There were two little girls, yeah, right there, and then there was,
they're like, we're not little girls.
Young ladies.
Hi, I'm Aria. I dance at Philadelphia Dance Theater.
Awesome.
And I just got on point, and so I'm wondering, what was your first pair of point shoes?
My first pair of point shoes. That is very exciting. It's going to be painful, but be patient. The more you do it, the less pain you'll feel, too. my first pair of point shoes were called Pavlovas, and I don't even think they make them anymore. They were bubblegum pink. Like, it was ridiculous. Like, they looked so silly. They were like a very old-fashioned point shoe. Like, they had really small box. Like, I mean, like, how the dancers used to dance. I'm like, how did they do anything in these? How do they balance? How do they turn? But, yeah, they were so hard. I think I grew out of them before I broke them.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth, and I wanted to know what was your first role, I mean, your favorite role that you've done, and why it was your favorite?
Thank you. I, at this stage in my life and career, I really enjoy the story ballets, like the really full and rich acting roles. So I'd say my all-time favorite to perform is Juliet in Romeo and Juliet. I think even the older I get, I just have, you know, you bring different things that you've experienced in your life. Like, I can't wait to go back on stage now that I'm a mom, and having that experience and bringing those, I don't know, emotions and things into these different roles that I perform. But definitely Juliet.
Hi.
Hi. my name is Kari, and I just wanted to ask, because you've been an inspiration to me all my life, and I just wanted to ask, have you ever been, like, intimidated by anyone, or has, like, anybody really made you, like, nervous, or, like, any roles that made you nervous? Like, has anything really, like, got to you?
Oh, thank you for that. I would say that Natalia Makarva, I don't know if you guys know who that is. I mean, she's a ballerina superstar, and I'd say that she's probably one of the only people that have made me feel really intimidated. She's someone who comes from that old Russian school of thought, and you know, it was a different approach than I'd really ever experienced training in America. She really challenged me and pushed me in this very tough love way when I was approaching the role of Gamzati in the ballet La Bayadere, in a way that I think both scarred me and challenged me to be better.
Hi, my name is Brielle, and I wanted to know what your favorite part of dance is.
Oh, thank you, Brielle. Gosh, it's going to sound so cheesy, but I love all of it. I love, like, there's some people that, like, prefer to be in the studio, and, like, there's, like, a safety, and, like, they love the process, and there's people that, like, love to be on stage and performing, and they're like, just get me out of the studio. But I love it all. I love, like, the journey that you go on, the accomplishment you feel, like, even just getting through, like, a rehearsal period, which we have rehearsal periods and we have performance periods, in a professional dancer's life. And there's just something about, like, getting through that journey of making it to the stage and feeling that accomplishment, and then getting through a ballet or through a performance tour season. It's just, there's nothing like it. And, well, there's one thing I experienced that was similar, and it was giving birth, which is, I know, like, it's kind of crazy. But there is something about, I don't know, that journey of, like, creation and then giving birth to. I mean, I was like, oh, this is very familiar. Like, getting my mental and emotional and physical all, like, prepared and together. It was a very interesting feeling.
And hopefully the ballet loves you, but that baby will definitely love you forever. Wow, we have so many hands in the middle. Why don't we do this? We'll start in the back and let you work your way down.
My name is Vanessa. I've been dancing almost my entire life.
Wow.
But
I work for an accounting firm now, so. But what I want to say is I teach a kind of an adult ballet class, and I get different levels in my class, and I try to make sure everybody leaves with some form of fun, and that's been exciting. But sometimes I have a difficult time because I do have dancers there that are probably 50, 60 years old, and they are trained dancers. They have taken dance for a long time. So I'm waiting for you to make some videos. So you can sell them, and we will buy them, and then I will know what to do with this group, because I have one woman, honestly, she tells me that you talk to her in her head. She thinks you're her best friend. So wait till I tell her on Thursday that I spoke to you.
Oh, but amazing. Please,
that is wonderful.
Please let me know when those videos are coming out.
When you're done with the board and the baby and everything else, you can get started on those videos. Okay, there's somebody in this person and the person in pink next to them. Yeah.
Hi, it's so wonderful to have you here.
Thank you.
Speaking of videos, she does have one on Masterclass.
Yes, I do.
Which I took, painfully.
Thank you.
in the privacy of my own living room. But your story is so remarkable. One thing that shines out is how you are a natural talent for ballet. Could you please speak to the process of learning the craft in addition to celebrating your natural talents? Because I think so many young people want to hop skip over the work and become Insta, YouTube, something famous in a heartbeat. So would you mind?
Like thank my
you
child,
again.
Yes.
Right,
yes.
Like mine too.
You know, something that, thank you for pointing this out. I think it's a really important like topic and conversation to have, especially today, like in this day and age. Something that's so unique about ballet is that there are no shortcuts. Like there's no shortcut journey to being able to get on stage and do it. You know, it's choreography that has existed for hundreds of years, and you have to go through a certain process in order to be able to have the stamina and have the strength and the consistency. It's doing something over and over and over again and putting in the time and putting in the work. And I think that's something that I've been so drawn to about ballet since I was really young, was having something that was constant, that was like stable in my life, because I didn't have that in my upbringing. There was not stability at all. Like from day to day, I wouldn't often know where we were going to be staying. You know, there was so much chaos, and ballet was so stable. And I think there's something so beautiful about that, again, especially in this day and age, that it's a time that you can put your phones away. You are simply focused on this thing that you're doing for an hour and a half or however many classes you're taking in a day. And there's something so precious and so powerful about having that time to focus on yourself. But yeah, I mean, the process, it's as a professional, it's 8 hours a day, 5 to 6 days a week. Sometimes, you know, without even a lunch break in between, like that's been my journey for 23 years as a professional. And it's such an incredible feeling, though, to put in that work and accomplish something you set your mind to.
My name is Amina. I'm a hip-hop dancer, and cool. I'm thinking about taking ballet now that I'm hearing you talk.
Oh, awesome.
You said that you started at 13 on a gym floor in socks and gym shorts. But like, and it felt awkward. But what made you like really keep going? Like really like what made it feel like it was right for you?
Yeah. Thank you, Mina. It was having someone believe in me that, you know, again, like my single mom was just trying, we were trying to survive. She didn't have a lot of time to put in focus on each of us kids. There wasn't really anything that was solely ours. We shared everything. And it was the first time in my life that I had a teacher that believed in me and was nurturing me and investing in me. I think that was initially what I was drawn to. And then I realized that I was really good at this thing. And it was also the first time that I, because, you know, I did well in school because I, again, I was a Virgo and a very nervous child and like just was like, I have to do good and make things as easy as possible for my mom. But nothing ever felt like it was for me. And there was something about the ballet technique that was very easy on my body. Like all the things that made me awkward and ugly and different in the world, I was perfect for ballet. You know, having big feet and long skinny legs and this tiny little peanut head and I, you know, all these things that I was made fun of for, I got into the ballet studio and it was like, oh, you have the perfect proportions for ballet, and Balanchine would have coined you like the perfect ballerina outside of my brown skin, but he would have coined you, you know, all. And so it was something that I just, you know, it was naturally something that worked for my body.
Hi, Misty. My name is Diana, and hi. I'm also Mariah Carey's number one fan, so we have that in common. I have a ballet class of ages 7 to 9, and at that age, you know, sometimes it could be a little tedious, mm-hmm. a little boring, not to me, but to them. So I want your advice on what should I tell them to keep on going, and ballet is the foundation, and mm-hmm. it'll help with other styles of dance. What would you say to our 7 to 9 year old dancers?
You know, I think that there are ways of making it fun. You know, it's something that I've been challenged with, but also excited to think about how we can approach the ballet technique in a way that might be more appealing to people from all different backgrounds, especially young people and especially in that age group. And through my foundation with the Be Bold program that I started, I've created my own curriculum. And it's to find a way of making ballet joyful. You know, joyful rigor is what we call it. And I think that there are ways to make, you know, I think it's about giving them things that are going to challenge them, but also letting them know that it's supposed to be fun, so that it's not, it's, you know, that you're not always kind of preaching to them, but that they have a voice within, you know, what they're doing, the decisions that are being made. I think it's important to challenge them to use their creativeness and their brains, that, you know, we're so, it's just a part of the ballet tradition and history that we don't talk as dancers in the classroom, especially we're being talked at. I think it's important to let them know that they're individuals and that they're, you know, we're always taught to, even as a 40-year-old in ballet world, we're still called children and students. And we're not always respected as individuals and adults that we can make decisions. And I think it's important to empower young people, you know, that they have agency over themselves.
Misty, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.